This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hambridge. On today's episode, crop consultant Darren Dunham shares about some of the soil-related challenges farmers are facing in his area of North Central North Dakota. Darren lives in Max Bass, where he's worked there for Central Crop Consulting for the past 10 years. He grew up on a farm in the eastern part of the state, so we talk about some of the differences in soil health building practices from the Red River Valley area to the area he lives in now, and how Darren is helping farmers with what is often their largest soil-related challenge, salinity. I also asked Darren how he incorporates soil health advice into his overall crop consulting services. First, though, Darren's going to take us back to the beginning, when, as a kid, he started to appreciate the importance of soil health.
You know, I started driving tractor when I was 7 years old, and my first job, let's call it, was plowing. We would plow all the wheat stubble after harvest. And as a seven-year-old kid who loved tractors, I absolutely loved that. But it became pretty obvious even to my dad, you know, then that it's taking too much time. Plus, we're leaving no residue on top of the soil. So I would say, you know, we switched to mulch tillage, you know, chisel plows, things like that to leave more residue when I was probably in junior high, high school. And then, like I mentioned, when I came back to the farm, that was the system we were in. And one particular thing I did, and this will kind of lead into the saline soils issue, is that we rented a quarter land, and it was in really rough shape. You know, it had drainage in it, but it wasn't well maintained, and it was seriously saline. So that's when we decided to start raising alfalfa. Other commodity prices were low, so we get into raising high-quality alfalfa, shooting for the dairy market in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa. Make the long story short, we had that ground in alfalfa, and I like the alfalfa because, you know, saline management is about managing water, and the alfalfa is the biggest water-using crop that we have in North Dakota. So after 7 years in alfalfa, we killed it, no-tilled corn into it, and you imagine this ground, the year I put alfalfa in it, we had maybe a 45-bushel barley crop, you know, which is, at that time, maybe a little more than half of what you'd expect out of a normal field. So it gives you some idea. And then, so this corn crop that we no-tilled in, we were 140 plus bushels. It was really good. The alfalfa had made a big difference. We saw white spots in the field that had grew nothing, you know, gradually began to grow, you know, kochia and foxtail barley, and still using all the water, eventually it shaped the ground up. So I'd say that's a long answer to a question of when I got into soil health, but I'd say early on in my career as an agronomist and certainly as a farmer, you know, back in the 90s.
Those early experiences have stuck with Darren and inform how he gives advice to the farmers he works with. He mentioned that it took 7 or 8 years of that alfalfa to slowly improve those saline areas. But he said there's another experience that happened more recently that has helped to shape his perspective on the importance of soil health in the area.
One of my boys was working for a local farmer. And they were taking out an old farmstead just a few miles east of where I live here so they could farm it. And they were taking out a fence. And as they were pulling these fence posts out of the ground, they realized that they were on top of an old fence, that the old fence had been covered by soil from wind erosion. So they ended up, you know, pulling that fence too, I believe. And but you imagine, you know, those fence posts stick out of the ground almost 4 feet. That's 4 feet of soil that had drifted in there. And there's other cases. I know just a mile and a half southeast of the house here, there's an old prairie road you drive down, and it's a pasture there. And along that fence line, you see the fence, obviously, but in amidst the fence is fence posts sticking out of the ground about 8 inches, 6 inches, you know, old ones. So, but that was back in the day of plows and pony drills. Everything was, you know, tilled black. And, lost a lot of soil. It's heartbreaking to think about it, just the massive amount of soil nutrients, organic matter that is rearranged for one, but gone, period. There's a lot of it that, you know, once it gets in the air, it's gone. You know, it's maybe in the Atlantic Ocean or who knows where.
Unfortunately, topsoil blowing away is still a big issue in a lot of areas. Where Darren is now, north of Minot, minimum till and no-till have become really common, pretty much since the advent of the Concord air seeder. That's not the case in the Red River Valley, though, where Darren grew up. And although there are, of course, some big differences between the two areas that would contribute to this, there are also some big similarities.
Okay, so yeah, the unique thing and the thing that I didn't realize is really until a couple of years before moving up here is that, Botineau County, or a big part of Botineau County, is in the bottom of a glacial lake, a historical glacial lake that's comparable in timetable to Lake Agassiz that the entire Red River Valley of North Dakota and Minnesota was under thousands of years ago. So consequently, we have similar soils to eastern North Dakota. We've got Fargo, silty clay loams and Great Bend clays. Where I live here, I'm near Max Bass, between Max Bass and Newburgh, North Dakota. On the West Beach, you might call it, but Emden fine sandy loams, Gardena loams. I remember Gardena loam was one of the soil types that when I was a consultant in Richland County that I would find down there out west of Windmere or around Windmere type of thing. So it's similar soils to what you find in, Red River Valley and surrounding area.
So how are farmers making no-till work in these heavier soils? Darren says it varies in his area based on the type of opener that they use.
We deal with two types of openers, either a shank opener, so whether you're talking a Dutch opener or we're talking disc openers, thinking like a 1895 John Deere no-till drill or a Bergot, a fair amount of Bergot here too. So the heavier soils, I would say I kind of prefer the disc opener there. And it's a question that we deal with every year. Almost all the farmers, we have discussions, which opener do you think, worked better in these conditions and what do you like better? My go-to phrase is whichever one you have, you have to be an expert using. So I think there's ways you can find to make each of them work, but you have to know what conditions you can get away with and effectively work with those things. And some growers will have each. If it's a large enough farm or some, I've got growers that have both shank machine and a disc opener, and they usually farm some of the heavier ground and some of the lighter ground. So they can use whichever tool is most effective. So, but a critical part of it is choosing the timing. Is it too wet? Is it too dry? And anybody that farms heavy soil knows that there's a limited window. It goes from being too wet to just right to being too dry more quickly. And I think a big part of this, the mindset in this neighborhood, even though we've, like I said, in 13 and 14, we've had a lot of wet years and now we're moving into drier years. Moisture management is a huge part of this, reducing tillage to make sure that we're maximizing our moisture retention and snow catch to facilitate next year's crop.
And moisture management is also a big part of managing one of the most significant problems in North Dakota soils, salinity.
Well, I think salinity in general is, it's a problem almost throughout the state of North Dakota, especially when you consider, in this area, the western part is prairie potholes. We've got some lands not drained, so you get the typical saline ring around sloughs or along wetlands. We also deal with, some, I wouldn't say we have a lot of hills, but we do have some areas where we've got seeps that are coming off of slopes, that type of thing. But to characterize how widespread the problem is, it's I'd say 80 or 90% of the farmland has spots with issue, any given portion of land, and it's anywhere from, maybe a couple percent to, maybe even 10% of some fields. So, I'd shake out the average somewhere in that 4 or 5% area, just as a guess.
And you heard earlier how Darren managed saline spots on his farm when he was farming full time. He says that's one good approach, certainly, but the right answer for how to handle salinity is not always straightforward or quick.
And there's a lot of different ways to deal with it. Most of my farms are using some type of precision ag. One of the first things we're doing is at least using that to limit the amount of inputs we're putting in these saline, whether they're non-productive or less productive. So we're either cutting back our fertilizers a great deal or switching to a more hardy soybean variety, a soybean that handles salinity better. That's some of the first steps. So I call that high-tech precision ag. And after some time of dealing with this, you just kind of know that, okay, this is really, really a bad area and we are perennially losing money on this. We'll do some what I call low-tech precision ag, and we will take those areas. And this works easier for guys who have livestock in their operation, but certainly isn't, exclusive to them. But we'll take portions of field just out of crop production. And my rule of thumb for doing this would be, for each acre you have that is producing zero, probably take an acre additionally that is producing something, that has something growing on it. And then we're establishing a mixture of alfalfa and salt-tolerant grasses. One that we use quite a bit has been AC Saltlander. Its genetics, I think, are some intermediate wheatgrass or some type of wheatgrass also crossed with quackgrass. Pretty salt tolerant, and it also spreads a little bit. It's got some rhizome activity, so it'll move. The idea here being is that, again, salinity is a water issue. You have to manage the water. So other than putting tile into the field, we're going to suck the water through plants. And alfalfa is the number one water user crop that we have in North Dakota. If we can utilize that, you know, it's a really good forage. So it works well with livestock. Anyway, so the alfalfa is hopefully intercepting that water that is moving by capillary pressure to that saline spot, intercepting it before it has a chance to, let's call it, percolate to the top of the soil, evaporate, and leave its salt as precipitate on top of the soil. So we're stopping the flow of salt and water to the soil surface. And over time, years for sure, you know, maybe we're talking 7, 8, 9, 10 years, we'll see improvement. Because, you know, it kind of, the next question usually is, well, when can you put those acres back into crop production? I'm not so sure that you always can. There's maybe 20% of the time you can, but we'll still keep an eye on it. And if it starts to go backwards again and develop more salinity, we'll go right back into the same, you know, grass and alfalfa mix. But what we found is that, you know, once you get through that first year or two of establishing the alfalfa and the grass, production is really good. The soil obviously is moist. You know, the water is moving there. It's full of nutrients because for years and years and years, it's been fertilized. So it's, your phosphorus levels are really high. Nitrogen levels are, you know, fine. It's either denitrified or leached away. So we don't have to fertilize, and we get really, really good forage production. So I think step one, you know, from agronomy or the economy side of it, is stop investing money in a piece of ground that is not paying you back. That's the first step. And so maybe we're thinking, well, that's just going to lay fallow. We don't really want that. That's not really good. So then it's examining, okay, what are your values? One guy might want a return on it. So I'm going to put a forage in there and I'm going to feed it to my livestock. Or maybe I'm going to plant, establish the perennials, and I'm going to fence it and I'm going to feed my livestock that way. Maybe another guy doesn't have the livestock available or doesn't, you know, have, you know, an avenue to sell the hay. And that's fine. Establish it to a perennial and just leave it. But the number one thing is you've stopped spending $100, $150 per acre on something that you're getting a zero return. So go back to that number of, you know, let's say 5% of any given farm is affected by saline soil. So if we took that 5% and said, okay, we are not going to invest any inputs, we're not going to put our $150 an acre in inputs in that, that's an immediate 5% reduction in your farm input costs. That's a direct impact on your profitability. So that's case number one. Another one is, as soon as you take those zeros and those very low yields out of your crop average, your average yields go up. So your APH yields, your insurability increases too. That one makes an awful lot of sense. There's a couple of really, really strong economic cases to be made for doing something like this.
But getting saline tolerant crops established in some of these spots is easier said than done. In order to get that long-term benefit of having something growing in those spots, a big part of the trick is finding a way to get it established there in the first place.
Okay, so establishment, we're seeding them into, yeah, right through the white spots. We know that there's certain areas that nothing is going to grow. So, but like I said before, we're seeding for each acre of white soil, let's call it, that we know nothing's going to grow, we're going to take an additional acre adjacent to it so that that white spot is surrounded by well-established crop. And what you'll see is the closer you get to that white spot or the higher salt, it'll be mostly the saltlander grass that grows and really not any alfalfa. And as you move further away, you'll have both saltlander and alfalfa. But the biggest thing is that alfalfa is adjacent to those areas so that it's intercepting the water that's percolating to that spot. But just your normal 5 to 8 pounds of alfalfa seed. And I think I've talked to guys, some of the guys that have developed this grass, and they say that, you know, even if you mix the saltlander with something else, some other grasses, eventually the saltlander is what's going to dominate because it does spread and it's more aggressive. You know, it's not as aggressive as like a quack grass. So I don't think we're in danger of developing a weed problem from it, but it does spread. So you'll find it does move in. And then, you know, maybe after year three or four, you could probably try to seed more. If it's not spreading adequately into those areas, you could try again. But, you know, after that initial year of seeding, you know, which you're probably talking $80 an acre in seed, really your investment is over. You know, it's just going to be harvest hay after that.
And what about tile helping in this situation? Darren says, while tile is very helpful for moisture management, it's definitely not a cure-all for salinity problems.
At the Dirt Workshop in Fargo, I was on a panel with Naeem. He brought out a point that hadn't really occurred to me in terms of tile. And I'm not knocking tile. I think tile is an effective way to move water. And again, that's what we're doing here, trying to manage saline soils, is we're managing water. But the tile will take the excess water. So we'll call it the non-capillary water. But once you get to the point, you imagine that that tile is surrounded by a sponge. Once you get to the point where the water is not dripping out of that sponge into the tile, you still have capillary water. And that capillary water, if at the surface of the soil, if water is evaporating, that capillary water is still going to move to the surface and evaporate off. So I don't think it's a cure-all. So in combination with tile, I still think you have to have a plant using that capillary water so that the water doesn't find a way to evaporate off the surface. And so that means, one, grow something, and two, if you can, leave some residue on the surface. And by all means, tillage is a no-no. Do not till saline soils, because you're reducing your soil cover and you're just turbocharging the evaporation off that surface.
And Naeem, who we mentioned there, is Naeem Kaur at NDSU. You can find previous episodes of this podcast with Naeem specifically talking about salinity and sodicity, and we'll leave a couple links for those in the show notes. But Darren said earlier that it does seem like they're entering more of a drier pattern right now, which makes me wonder, how do these approaches to salinity management change, if at all, in more of a drier environment?
That's a good question. Probably not at all if we're going to manage it. But what we have found too is in the last few years where we've been drier, that the salinity problem seems to dissipate. And I think, well, there's not excess moisture in the system, so that when we do catch a rain, that water is more likely to percolate down through the profile and dilute those salts, you know, out of the top few inches of soil in the growing zone anyway. But either way, in terms of how it impacts how we establish crops in that, I still think you just need to go do it. You need to just go seed. And even if it's dry, the alfalfa seed will be there when it rains. The grass will get there. It takes some time to get things established. But if the seed is not there, it's not going to grow. So you got to do it.
And a lot of these approaches to salinity management get back to a fundamental principle of soil health, which is keeping a living root in the soil as much as possible. And cover crops can be a great way to do this. But in areas with short growing seasons, like the northern part of North Dakota, there's some real challenges to getting them in any given year.
We've had guys try cover crops, you know, anything from small grain seeded in the fall to some of the clovers, red clover, mustards, turnips, radishes, and that's fine. But what we find is that we're far enough north that our pea harvest, we've got some acres of peas, like I said, but our wheat harvest, canola harvest are late. We generally don't really start harvesting wheat until at least mid to late August. And sometimes, like even last year, we barely started before September. So consequently, the time you get the wheat harvested and get in there to seed a cover crop, you're usually in September, maybe mid-September, and there's just not time to establish a hardy crop, certainly in terms of an annual. And that's not saying that, you know, the root growth under the ground is helpful, so I wouldn't discourage it. But I think a more effective angle on it is using maybe winter annuals or biennials. We've had some good success using rye, especially in PP years. But I think rye is a good one, because even if you could just get it established in the fall, you're going to get some growth in the spring from it. And so if we're in a wet cycle and we want to manage water with this cover crop, rye is a great choice, because it's so aggressive in the spring. you think about all the things that cover crops do for you: erosion limitation, cycling nutrients, managing water, and actually providing nutrients is one that I would like to play with, because, you know, the last year now we've had extremely high nitrogen prices. And this is my brainstorming. I haven't done this yet, but you think old school ag, North Dakota, before we had chemical fertilizers, you know, sweet clover was used as a plow down, you know, for nitrogen. And there again, that's a biennial crop. I think we could seed that, either fly it on to the wheat before it's harvested, or maybe seed it right after. And as long as you get it established, you should have some pretty good growth in the spring. But to incorporate that somehow, so we could actually get all the other benefits from erosion to soil health, but also capture some nutrients from it as well. So that's something I'd like to play with. I can't say that I've had anybody do that. Everybody's interested in soil health, but I got two or three guys that are, all right, we really need to do something. We really need to try something different. Another thing I would like to do, and incorporate this with the cover crop, is figure out a way to add livestock to some of this ground. Even if it's mob grazing, you know, where we like, say, for example, you had a rye crop that's taken off in the springtime, you know, by the time that it gets to jointing stage, if it was fenced, and if we could put a lot of cattle in there over the course of maybe a week or 10 days and really aggressively graze that, get the cattle out of there by end of May and still have time, we could still put a canola crop or a soybean crop or something like that. The number one issue there that I see holding that back is moisture management. You know, so there's going to be years that we're going to be short. That's going to hurt us. There's going to be years that it's a big benefit. So, you know, it's weighing all those things and trying to establish some experience level with them, so you get comfortable and understand what benefits you're bringing and what you're sacrificing. And is that worth it?
Now, before we close out today's episode, I wanted to ask Darren just more generally about how he integrates his commitment to building healthier soils into his overall crop consulting agronomic services, and what advice he might have to others who may want to do the same.
You know, I think there's just a baseline in terms of soil health. There's a baseline of, number one, don't lose it. So that's why I like the no-till, keeping lots of residue on the soil. And the next thing is managing soil moisture. So nothing has really worked here in the fall. So the cases where we've got, you know, standing canola stubble, standing wheat stubble, we catch snow. Standing corn stalks, they catch snow, and that's a big benefit. The one I see that doesn't have that is soybeans. We shave them off the ground, and that's ground that we're more susceptible, you know, to erosion. So, you know, integrating that into what I'm doing as a consultant, that's number one. And then trying to creatively think about nutrient management through these cover crops, like I said, maybe with some clovers or things like that. These are things I want to experiment with. And at some point, you know, I guess I like to see progress. We all like to see progress really quickly. But I think, I don't know if I can make a sports analogy too. In a lot of ways, I look at it as a baseball game. You know, that managers in baseball games are, you know, when you put a left-handed batter against a left-handed pitcher, it's just not an absolute that this is going to work. But we know that the percentages are now more in your favor, that over time, you're going to have more wins than you would have otherwise. So that's, I think, what we're trying to do is make good decisions. We have a saying too in the company that what you would have done last year that was right doesn't necessarily mean that that's the right thing to do this year. I don't know if I kind of butchered that a little bit, but the right thing to do last year is not necessarily the right thing to do this year. And you don't know that until the season's over. So I think you continue to do what you believe are the right things. And when you learn that something you did, you know, didn't work, don't necessarily abandon it. Case in point, I had I know a guy that tried to establish some of this alfalfa in some saline soils. And like I said before, it's like a couple year process to get it really well established. Within a few months, it didn't establish well. It didn't work. And I was like, well, it didn't really have a chance to work. We got to give this some time. I guess what I'm getting at is, in the beginning, is be careful how you define success. You know, take a long view of it and give things time to work, and don't necessarily abandon a practice because it didn't work by your original definition of work in the first place, and try to make adjustments to it. You know, give it more than one chance. Persistence is important.
Well, fantastic advice. A great place to end right there. Thank you very much to Darren Dunham for taking the time to be on today's episode. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I think he shared some real practical advice and perspective. Thanks so much to the sponsors of this season of Soil Sense: the North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Soybean Council, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from this podcast, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and review on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts or both. And please share your favorite episodes on Twitter using the hashtag SoilSense. We'll be back with another episode of Soil Sense next week.